any discussion of black nationalism, Pan-Africanism, or the militant civil rights movement would have to include a significant reference to the life and work of Malcolm X. Born in 1925, Malcolm Little, later to be known as Malcolm X, would move through various trials and tribulations to become the key spokesperson of the Nation of Islam and later the founder of the Organization of Afro-American Unity and the Muslim Mosque Incorporated. After his expulsion from the Nation of Islam in 1963, Malcolm became increasingly involved in international affairs, with two visits to the African continent and the Middle East and contacts with leaders like Julius Nyerere of Tanzania, Milton Obote of Uganda, and Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana. Throughout his speeches after 1963, Malcolm made reference to the countries of China, Vietnam, South Africa, the Congo, and the Bandung Conference of 1955. His public character after his break with the Nation of Islam reflected a national and international leader who sought to make the connections between African Americans and Africans on the African continent. Joining Africa today to discuss Malcolm X is Dr. Abdul Akalimat, a professor of sociology and Africana studies at the University of Toledo at Ohio. Dr. Akalimat is the cyber organizer for Malcolm X, a research site. Malcolm X, the website can be located at www.brothermalcolmoneword.net. Abdul, thanks for joining Africa today.
Thank you for having me back again.
Good. Yeah, I think it was probably about 6 or 7 months ago that we spoke about it, and the interest is, as usual, is always high about Malcolm, and your presentation about the website was particularly of interest to our listeners. So we want to continue with some of the themes that we didn't talk about in the first half hour. There's been, at least my perception is, a growing appreciation of the work of Malcolm X. Is that your analysis, and if so, why? Why do you think so?
Well, it's hard to say growing. I think what has happened is several things have happened with different sectors of society. I think that the in the inner city community, in the forbidden zones of the what Malcolm called field Negroes, there's always been a great love and admiration for Malcolm X and a, let's say, a continuity of interest. That's always been there. I think that in the early 90s, there was an upswing around the mainstream media giving play to the film that was developed by Spike Lee. I think also family events, particularly the death of Betty Shabazz, gave some new currency to the way the mainstream dealt with it. But I think that the biggest connection is the fact that such a large segment of the African American community are facing such hard times, be they economic hard times with low-paying, relatively unstable jobs and various levels of permanent unemployment, facing the cutoff of welfare with the new laws, and also the police terror that's running through cities, whether it's New York or Los Angeles or Toledo, for that matter. The fact is that things are getting pretty rough right now for an increasing number of people, and youth in particular, and black women even more so, so that people are looking for a person or a body of ideas that is consistent with their experience. And the one thing about Malcolm, no matter how much people try to mainstream Malcolm with a federal stamp and with so many other things, as well as calling a generation the X generation, I mean, there are all kinds of dialogues going on with Malcolm X in that regard. The fact is that the Malcolm tapes, the Malcolm speeches, and the Malcolm films bring forward a brother who speaks directly to the kind of terror and the kind of absolute insecurity that people are facing. And so Malcolm remains as current today, perhaps even more so today than he was when he was alive, for that sector of people who are experiencing what he talked about, and that's a large section of people.
I know whenever one travels to the major cities of the United States and you walk by the men and women who sell the tapes of speeches of Louis Farrakhan. There's always a good selection of Malcolm's. But to the point, what made Abdullah Kalimat? Give us something about your background, because obviously your work as a cyber organizer for the Malcolm X page and your research about Malcolm is a labor of love and of interest. What brought you to this appreciation and this analysis of Malcolm X in our history?
Well, I think to be absolutely candid, there's several points. First, I have a history in my family of struggle. Out of that, also living in Chicago, which was the headquarters of the Nation of Islam, and where they had their greatest economic activity and the greatest distribution of the newspaper, Muhammad Speaks. And so I, like many others, was approached on a bus stop and fished, as they call it, into the temple to hear and to dialogue with, in that case, it was Mr. Minister James 2X in Chicago. And, so that the Nation of Islam was there. And what we have to remember is when Nation of Islam made its big impact in the 60s, they would walk up in a shirt and tie and approach somebody, and a black man, for example, and call him sir and mister. And at that point, given the extent of segregation and racism and the devaluing of black people, that was a refreshing and wonderful thing to have happen. So there was an acceptance that they had a role to play. They were making a contribution. Now, there are many other ideas, of course, that I didn't agree with, but there were many that I did. The other thing is that the Muhammad Speaks was a newspaper, interestingly enough, that was, during the early days, often edited by a communist. That is, someone who believed in socialism and someone who was in support of the national liberation struggles occurring. So when we read Muhammad Speaks, we were reading about the Vietnam War from the point of view of the Vietnamese. We were reading about Africa from the point of view of the African Liberation Organizations, from direct press releases from revolutionary headquarters. Now, that was in addition to the centerfold, which was written by Elijah Muhammad about the mothership and about the myth of Yaqub and so forth. So you got both. And I think the way the movement was drawn to Muhammad Speaks had something to do with progressive politics that were being put forward. But directly to Malcolm, the thing about Malcolm is that Malcolm was black everyman. His life went through stages, and along the way, he had experiences that everyone could identify with. And so he picked us all up in his brief but very comprehensive stages of his life. And he was a person who embodied two things that absolutely captured black youth. First, he was absolutely articulate in speaking truth to power. And so he was in the media, he was on television, he was on the radio. And secondly, he was absolutely honest and moral. And both of those things, I think, really were shocking that we could have someone who was prepared to risk his life and to risk not just life and death, but risk being poor, to risk being ridiculed by speaking those things that black people believed but no one was saying. Because out of slavery, there was always a tradition of silence and whispering, so that there were two realities. There was one reality you gave to the mainstream and you gave to white people. There was another reality that you shared in the black community. Malcolm broke the silence. Malcolm spoke up, and in fact, it felt good to people. It felt good to us when he spoke truth to power. It was therapeutic for us. In fact, I'm saying it now thinking we need that today. We need somebody to start speaking up. I mean, look, we've got a leader like Jesse Jackson, for instance, who claims to represent a continuation of the tradition of Martin Luther King, and he goes off to Sierra Leone representing the U.S. government. Now, I can't imagine going anywhere in the world representing the U.S. government in all of the imperialist and aggressive and absolutely negative role that the United States plays in the world, carrying a mandate from the President of the United States to intervene in Africa and actually think in any way that you are there representing the interests of Africa. You are there representing the interests of Bill Gates and the corporate basis of state power in the United States. So we're in a period where black leadership has a relationship with the big house, exactly what Malcolm was talking about. But we don't have clear voices that continue the tradition that Malcolm represented.
You, Abdul, you work actually with, you're the cyber organizer for two different sites. One is the Brother Malcolm site, and the other one is a African-American list server. Say just a bit about both of those, and we'll get more into Malcolm.
Yeah, well, you know, this question of cyberspace is absolutely important because we're talking about the norm for the 21st century. And so it's just a matter of how fast everybody gets online. Now, we have a listserv called H-Afro-AM, which is a part of HNET, which is based at Michigan State. We have about 1,700 people online that receive email every day discussing research regarding the African-American experience. So we have graduate students, we have the media people, we have all kinds of people writing questions. We've discussed naming practices, we've discussed literature, historical events, and so on. Now, the other website that's connected really to HAFROAM is what we call eBlack Studies. It's www.e, that's the letter E, blackstudies.net, which is a general site on the black studies in cyberspace. And you'd be amazed how much stuff is being put up. We have, for example, a section called online texts. These are texts that are out of copyright that have been completely scanned in. So, for example, you can go and you can read Frederick Douglass, and the entire text is online for free. You can read Du Bois, the entire text is online for free. You can read Francis Harper. You can read Martin Delaney. There's so many people who are online for free, and so we're trying to make all of these resources available. But in addition to that, we're also trying to work locally, and we've got a project here where we're trying to put the black church online. The main street that ran through the black community all the way past the Fortune 500 corporation out into the rural farm area is called Door Street, very symbolically called Door Street in Toledo. And we're going to put the entire Door Street online and actually give home pages to people who live on Door Street, everyday people with their family and family reunions and ability to communicate and to connect. In other words, what we think is that everything that's actual must become virtual. Everything that is real in our everyday sense of our five senses and our going around as human beings, we think will have a reflection in cyberspace where we will be able to move faster, communicate with more people, absorb more information, and it will be a global thing. In fact, they have already, the companies, the internet companies, have already planted the basis for extending the internet to outer space. So we're, you know, in exact keeping touch with the 21st century when we start talking about moving things into cyberspace. Now, a lot of people will say that poor people and others are not really able to get to cyberspace, and therefore it's a bad thing to talk about cyberspace. I just want to remind people of this. When Frederick Douglass started a newspaper, most black people were slaves and couldn't read. But his newspaper was absolutely essential at that stage of the liberation struggle. And in fact, it directly linked with a fight by people for schooling and for literacy. That was part of the struggle against slavery. And I think today we face an exact parallel situation where to initiate a website and to initiate listservs is not because most black people are there, but because the digital divide is something we have to fight to overcome, and we are going to use the state-of-the-art tools for collecting, gathering, analyzing, and disseminating information and for communication, because we have to use the state-of-the-art tools. But at the same time, we recognize every time that is the case, same thing was true with the radio. When people started using the radio, Most black people didn't own their own homes, didn't have electricity, and couldn't turn it on. But these are battles we have to fight. And so that we are trying to put on the table of the black liberation movement the notion of fighting to overcome the digital divide. So we have these websites and these listservs, and we hope that people begin to more actively use these things. You can go to your public library and get access for free if you don't have these things at home. And a lot of community centers are beginning to establish a computer option so that we are very, very excited about this, because we can catch up using the Internet. We can make a giant leap through history using this new technology. I think everybody listening to this program knows that black people need a giant leap through history.
We're listening to the voice of Dr. Abdullah Kalimat, a professor of sociology and Africana studies at the University of Toledo in Ohio. Dr. Kalimat is the cyber organizer for Malcolm X, a research site, which can be located at www.brothermalcolm.net. He also is working with the Black Studies Net, which is www.e.blackstudies.net. And he also works with the HAFRO-M program, and we'll give those out before we end today. You're listening to Dr. Kalimat on Africa Today, which is heard weekly on KPFA radio station in Berkeley, where we talk about developments relative to Africa and the African diaspora. Let's make a leap here and talk a bit, Abdul, about Malcolm X and the civil rights movement. And I wanted you to drop Malcolm and his relations with the Nation of Islam into this context of what's happening in the early 1960s, the civil rights movement, the Freedom Summer, and perhaps define here what Malcolm was thinking from your analysis and how it interacted or didn't interact well with the Nation of Islam.
Well, it's an interesting question you raise is extremely interesting and helps us to understand the overall dynamic. First of all, Malcolm developed politically in, we can identify at least three major ways. First, under the direct tutelage of Elijah Muhammad. Clearly, when Malcolm connects with Elijah Muhammad while he's in prison and with his family members, who had also by then joined the Nation of Islam, he is pulled out of the quagmire of criminality. And now, mind you, throughout all these three points I'm going to mention, it was Malcolm's aggressive intellectual curiosity and his commitment to learning that propelled him through. But his tutelage came from Elijah Muhammad. And secondly, by the time he ends up going back to Harlem as minister of the Nation of Islam, he is now in touch with his school for criminality, the streets of Harlem. And at that point, Malcolm begins to take Elijah Muhammad's teaching into the streets of Harlem, and he begins to interact now not with just the criminality, but with the traditions of black radicalism that are on the street, Garveyism, the African nationalist pioneer movement, the great street corner speakers in Harlem, all of the people who had been keeping the radical black tradition of socialism and Pan-Africanism and nationalism alive in Harlem were there. And he began to dialogue with them, and under those conditions, he began to change. For example, in the Nation of Islam, they used to say that black people were from the East. When Malcolm took that line to the streets of Harlem, there was great Africa consciousness on the streets. And therefore, as a street corner speaker, he then had to engage people from all of these different nationalist and Pan-Africanist movements. It was then that Malcolm changed. And Malcolm started advancing the notion that black people have a particular relationship, not with the East in this ambiguous sort of direction, but directly to Africa. Now, of course, Elijah Muhammad's generation were people from small towns in the South who had grown up under the influence of mainstream negation of Africa and the Tarzan image and so on. And therefore, they did not identify with Africa. But it was Malcolm that broke through. Now, remember, of course, in the aftermath of World War II, with the Pan-African Congress in 45 in Manchester, and then subsequently the independence of Ghana in 57, and then Africa Year in 1960, Malcolm is simultaneous with this reawakening of Africa. So it fits, the reawakening of Africa internationally, on the ground, pro-Africa position in Harlem, Malcolm changed. And then, of course, the third great education was internationally, in talking to leaders of the African liberation movements and talking to leaders of world revolution and of Islam. Malcolm changed again because he had a narrow perspective that was peculiar to the United States. In other words, if one is black in this country and of a particular generation, one could easily interpret the world in purely color terms, in racialist terms. And when he went abroad, he saw that people, in fact, in the world are many different colors. And that skin color itself was not the fundamental issue, that the fundamental issue was the social relations among people, and he was interested in how do you get rid of the poverty and suffering and murder and sickness and all the things that black people faced, and come to find out that there were people who he met in Islam who were moral, who were also not black, and so on. So he learned a lot in those three ways. Now, in the civil rights movement, it was clear that that Malcolm was active in many ways. For example, there were people in the civil rights movement like Robert Williams. Now, Robert Williams is a figure from Monroe, North Carolina, who emerged as a militant ex-soldier who was not prepared to take low given the impending violence of the Ku Klux Klan, and organized people to pick up arms to resist the Klan. Malcolm in Harlem developed a tight relationship with Robert Williams and, in fact, raised money in Harlem to send to Robert Williams to buy more guns. So you have that kind of relationship. And, of course, Robert Williams is in the NAACP. They tried to throw him out. They couldn't entirely throw him out. He also has a relationship with King. But I just wanted to point out that that left wing, far militant wing of the civil rights movement, he also obviously ends up having a very strong relationship with SNCC. Now, in the earlier days of SNCC and the mass sit-in movement, et cetera, Malcolm ridiculed much of the civil rights movement. But that ridicule was within the context of the Nation of Islam, and which was to argue that fighting the monster of segregation and the demon of the U.S. government was not appropriate, and that what should happen is people should withdraw from civil life because it was the assumption that the country would self-destruct, and therefore the people who withdrew, circled their wagons to preserve themselves, would survive. Well, Malcolm had that perspective until people really started fighting back. And again, the militancy of the traditions in Harlem helped propel him forward, as well as the general uprising in the African-American community. And the tension between the Nation of Islam and the older, more religious, more sectarian forces, and Malcolm, who was more in touch with the broader social motion of the community, and particularly militant youth in the cities, that tension grew more and more. And really, that's at the base of a lot of the contradictions that led to Malcolm leaving the Nation of Islam.
What do you see, Abdul, as a relationship, as Malcolm saw it, between, let's use the word, religion and nationalism? Because after his expulsion from the Nation of Islam, he formed two organizations, the Organization of Afro-American Unity and the Muslim Mosque Incorporated. How did Malcolm see those two perspectives, if they can be called two perspectives, interacting?
Yeah, Malcolm was a, I think there's a an easy way to put it. Any religion has a set of beliefs and a set of rituals that are peculiar to it. And the same is true with a political organization. Malcolm saw the relationship being that every religion he came to believe had its validity, particularly as it helped to stabilize a person's life, and it provided a set of moral guidelines, because he constantly emphasized that brotherhood or that co-survival was based on a common understanding, a moral position, that we can relate to each other in a just way. His politics were politics. He constantly used nationalism as really a metaphor for organizing all in the interest of all black people. In other words, he was trying to say that there was a common agenda because we had common problems and therefore should have common solutions. And so Malcolm saw, you know, when he said we need to put our religion in the closet. In other words, we need to not make the differences in the rituals and beliefs, the dogma of our religious lives, the basis of our unity or disunity. We need to have that because we need moral guidelines, whether you're Christian or whether you're Islam or whether you're whatever you are. But on the other hand, that moral then has its manifestation in terms of power and struggle in the political arena. And that's why when he looked at Africa and saw the Organization of African Unity, he then got the idea to form the Organization of Afro-American Unity to unite all black people in a common struggle against the common enemy.
So both the Organization of Afro-American Unity and I believe the OAU actually is formed in 1963, and so the OAU, I think, is 1964. Is that correct?
Yes.
Maybe I'm using the wrong word here again, what pulled Malcolm to Africa? Because in 1964, Malcolm went to Africa and the Middle East on two occasions, and he went from the Algerias to the Ghanas to the Nigerias to the Liberias to the Lebanons. How do you analyze what Malcolm was looking for and what he brought back from those travels, Abdul?
Well, I think that there are two things. First, in the broadest sense, he was becoming an active participant in a long tradition. Black people have, since this days of slavery, since the days of the slave trade, been trying to get back to Africa. And each generation has had its own psychology and its own objectives. But every generation of black intellectuals, artists, sensitive, conscious people have tried to reestablish a link with Africa. And so Malcolm, in that sense, was following the Pan-Africanist tradition. But in his particular case, he was also going at a time when Africa was standing up, when Africa was having one of its best hours, one could say. And so when he went, for example, to an OAU meeting in Egypt, he was a guest of the OAAU, and he was accorded the same respect and given the same facilities as leaders of African liberation organizations that were engaged in armed struggle against colonial powers. And so he was there along with the ANC and SWAPO and the PAIGC of Guinea-Bissau and so forth, MPLA of Angola. And I think that is the key to understanding Malcolm's relationship to Africa. His conversations with Sekou Touré, with Kwame Nkrumah, with Julius Nyerere, with Babu of Tanzania, these conversations were conversations with the leaders of Africa in struggle against colonialism, and I might add, in successful struggle against colonialism, that is, direct colonial control. And so he was linking the African-American struggle to those struggles. And so when he, for example, back to your question on civil rights, when he advanced the notion we had time to move from civil rights to human rights, and put the struggle of the African-American people on the global stage, indicting the U.S. government for denying our human rights, Malcolm was a visionary and a prophetic leader of great proportions.